When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everybody. This is the Cricket Badger podcast.
Each badger marks the track with its own scent.
His black legs are short but very powerful for digging. The name badger probably comes from the French word bêcher, meaning digger.
Hello everybody, I am James the Cricket Badger and welcome along to another edition of the Cricket Badger podcast. And very excited about this one. We have basically a living legend of cricket journalism in our midst today, and welcome Ashield Berry to the podcast. He's got a new book out, perfectly timed for Christmas presents, and we will talk to him a little bit about that, a bit about the upcoming Ashes series as well. Ashield's been there many times covering the game, and I will bring him on so you can see him and welcoming to the podcast. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon, James. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. When was your last tour? It's kind of with COVID and everything, everything's kind of gone a little bit blurry, but I can remember Danny Rubin and George giving you a presentation. It was on Twitter.
It was early last year, February 2020, tour of South Africa. Yeah, the Johannesburg Test, which England won to clinch a series, to clinch a series 3-1. That was my last Test match. Abroad as the Telegraph's cricket correspondent. My esteemed colleague, Nick Holt, has taken over as cricket correspondent, and I'm now sort of slightly more backseat as the chief Telegraph cricket writer. So working from home a lot more.
That means you're not, that was your last tour then, wasn't it? So you won't be used to what the weather outside my window is, snow and cold and nastiness. You're usually in warmer climes at this time.
Well, last winter was my first complete winter at home in England since 1976. So I'm getting inured against a shock. But actually, it's been lovely, hasn't it, until the last couple of days when it's become really wintry. But I've always hated leaving England in September, October to go abroad, even November, before the leaves go. If you're going to go abroad, it's when the leaves have gone. And then take in January and February as well, if possible.
I introduced you there as a legendary cricket journalist. You've got a long and distinguished career behind you. You wrinkle your nose at that. Some would say, however, me included, that you're a very lucky person, that you, obviously, the skill is involved in the writing, but to have a career where you follow the sun, you follow England, you have a far longer career than a player does. I'd imagine there's some downs along the way, but it's been a decent time, I guess.
Yes. I mean, in a way, it's not by accident, because when I was a lad in my last year at uni, I thought, what's the best vacation job out there? And I thought, yeah, being a Sunday cricket correspondent, i.e. Working for The Observer. And that sort of kept going for another 40 odd years. And it was just as a souped up vacation job. It is the most wonderful existence. I am, yeah, the luckiest of people to have had that time ending, you know, just before COVID, I suppose. Everyone who's going on tour of Australia, I mean, it should be great cricket on the field, but it's not the lifestyle that it used to be. I think I've done 11 tours of Australia, and my goodness, some good times were had by day and by night.
I was going to mention COVID because you actually chose quite a good time to step away from it, didn't you, really, with everything that's going on in the world, kind of retiring from travelling abroad. Wasn't the worst time to do that?
I know, to think of filling out passenger locator forms at Heathrow. My lovely colleague Nick is due at Heathrow to fly to Australia today. And, yeah, just the bureaucracy now that must be involved.
Did the love of cricket come a long time before the job application, or did the cricket develop as a love?
I was born a mile from Bramall Lane, James. So, yeah, I mean, at the age of 5 or 6, I could remember the roar, you know, when Yorkshire had taken a wicket or something or won a game. So, yeah, I was born and brought up about a mile from Bramall Lane. And so my idyllic childhood years were spent there, when the 1960s, when Yorkshire won the championship 7 times in the decade, and they were so good that they beat Australia by an innings, West Indies by an innings, India, New Zealand. I'd be surprised. Yeah, I mean, so they were as good as any team in the world at home.
My surname has got 2 T's in it, and I spent most of my life, before Joss Butler came along and made it a lot easier for me, spent most of my life saying double T. I'd imagine your Christian name, which is spelled S-C-Y-L-D, Shield, I bet you've had to spell that a few times, haven't you?
Well, nobody asked me when I was at school. I just didn't bother going that far. It was quite convenient when I got to Australia and people asked me my name and on my second tour. I could say Shield as in Sheffield Shield, because I was born in Sheffield and they've got the Sheffield Shield. So what a mnemonic, as they say, a way to remember it.
Obviously, with all of the tours that you've done, is it 45, 46 years you spent travelling abroad?
Oh, no, not nearly as long. 77 till 2020. So that's only about 43, isn't it?
Yeah, well, getting on towards that then, isn't it? I mean, you're a single man to start with. Obviously, you've got a family and a wife partway through that. You need a fairly understanding family, I guess, if you're going to just disappear off to the sunshine for a while.
I'm not sure the kids noticed. occasionally I was able to bring them out on holiday. What could be better than going to today's test cricket and then going home to see your family? I mean, to have been able to done that. That was so lucky. My wife's the strongest person I've ever met, amongst several other superlatives. She overtly hardly battered an eye, went off, say, bye, darling, I'll be back in March or something. She managed to keep the show on the road with 3 kids. So I wouldn't have been able to do any of it without her.
A lot of talk about the England players getting their wives and girlfriends abroad this winter. Did Sunita's your wife, isn't it? Did she ever come across and spend a bit of time in the sun with you in the winters? Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, quite often, particularly if it was a Christmas tour abroad, then she'd come out. So I hope that she and the kids have had a good time in various locations around the world.
Ashes not too far away, only about 10 days now it starts. Will there be part of you envious that you're not there this time?
Yes, I mean, I suppose, when the first ball is about to be bowled, I'd love to be in Brisbane. Not so much in the present press box, because you're a sort of very wide extra cover. And it's sealed, air conditioned, so you can't hear the Gabba's cheering of Stuart Broad as he goes out there. And
I'm not sure cheering is the right word for that.
That's been played. And jeering should be pronounced, shouldn't it? Anyway, the real significant change in my time as a cricket correspondent was that when you went abroad 40 years ago, I don't think any press box was air-conditioned. They were all open to the elements. I mean, there would be a roof, so you didn't get sunstroke during the day. But otherwise, you know, every press box, you could be out there and not just see, but hear and feel and sense body language of the players, the mood of the crowd. But one by one, those senses have been taken away, so that almost every press box now is entirely insulated and air-conditioned and without a window. And so you can see what's going on. You know, maybe a very good view, like, say, from the Lord's press box. But you can't hear or feel or anything going on. I mean, I remember the when the new Lord's press box was unveiled in 2000, and England in that Lord's test bowled West Indies out for 50-odd. Apparently, some people got excited. I mean, there were people in the crowd who were shouting and cheering. In the press box, it was just complete silence. I mean, a pin could have dropped, you know, so none of the drama filtered through. Almost every press box is like that now. And also, I think the new one in Perth has got a press box that's sort of nearer behind the arm. But so many Australia's stadia don't have a good press box view. So that minimises my regret at not being there, the fact that you've got, you know, a better view on television.
You talk about that in the book, don't you? Might as well just name the book. It's on the title of this podcast, but Beyond the Boundaries, Travels on England Cricket Tours. I mean, I've been abroad a fair few times, not covering England, but covering county cricket pre-seasons and what have you. And I've been to South Africa and to the UAE and to Barbados. And you're right, everything is like sealed in. You can't really get the true atmosphere. You mentioned in the book, you have two wishes as a journalist. You want to be behind the bowler's arm so you get a good view, and you want to be able to get the atmosphere, which is nigh on impossible these days. And actually, you almost surprised me when I went to Johannesburg and the press box there is opened at the front.
Excellent.
Yeah, you can actually hear the crowd and feel the crowd, can't you? But that's almost impossible everywhere else.
I know. It's so sad. I think the only place where you actually want to be in an air-conditioned press box and sealed in is Sri Lanka, because it is so hot, particularly if you're not at the peak of fitness. I would have air-conditioned press boxes, Sri Lanka only. And Dunedin, because that's so cold, you need to be warmed up.
It's the holiday season, and that means there are stockings to be stuffed and elves to be cuffed. Today's sponsor, Manscaped, has gone global with the tools to guarantee you will score under the tree and the mistletoe. Manscaped is the leader in men's below-the-waist grooming, and they have served more than 4 million men worldwide. If my maths is correct, that's 8 million Christmas baubles. Get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Just quote the promo code Badger. Be the ballsiest gift giver this festive season with Manscaped.
Will you be staying up to watch the Ashes overnight, or will you be catching up the following day?
Well, I haven't really sort of quite worked out the way to go because Brisbane and Adelaide, there's about 4 hours time difference, isn't there? Because Adelaide's a day-nighter. So that changes the equation. I mean, it's all new to me because I didn't do the Ashes tour of 1991, but otherwise I haven't been at home for one since 1970s. So I'm not sure exactly what modus operandi is going to be most suitable.
What would be the Shiel Berry prediction for this five-match Ashes series? Do you think England have a chance?
All right, James, tell me, where are the Ashes, the five tests, going to be staged?
Well, it starts in Brisbane, doesn't it? And I, for the first time ever, I'm actually commentating on the first day of the third test at Melbourne. So my Christmas right. Day is going to be curtailed this year because I'm going to be on duty from, well, it starts right. at 11:30 right. at night. So that's the third test match. I mean, they tend to order them in Australia so that they try and get a decent advantage. But I've spoken to a couple of Australians who think that England might be able to catch them cold early on. Maybe that's just them being pessimistic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just wondering for COVID reasons where the matches are going to be, because it's always seemed very unlikely, and probably even more so now with our Omicron virus variant, that Perth isn't going to happen.
There's talk in the paper today, Shiel, that the fifth test might be revert back to Melbourne, so there might be two at Melbourne.
You're right, and that it has to be a day-nighter because the hours of Perth have to be replicated, which means the fifth test is then going to be a day-nighter. So we'll have two day-nighters. And you'd have thought Pink Ball might be favouring Jimmy Anderson. So tell me where the test matches are going to be played, you know, which ones are going to be day-nighters, and, you know, then I might have a stab at...
This is a very politician...
3-1 Aussie. 3-1 Aussie. But if Ben... Well, here come all the ifs and buts. I mean, if Ben Stokes comes off, then it's possible that England can draw or win. Because there's the basic template, isn't there? In the last 50 years, because we don't really count 78-9, because of World Series, in all those series, 70-71, 86-7 and 2010-11, one England batsman scored three test hundreds, so England got big runs. Geoffrey Boycott, Chris Broad, Alistair Cook, and one England pace bowler got 25 wickets or more. John Snow in 70-71, Jimmy Anderson last time, and 86-7 a bit different because you had Graham Dilley helped with the first test. Ian Botham, the fourth at Melbourne. And in between, John Embry and Phil Edmonds strangled Australia, kept them down to two runs and over. So that was a sort of bit of a different pattern. But the basic template there, somebody's got to make three test hundreds. Ben Stokes, your likeliest. And somebody's got to take 25 wickets in pace. But maybe that's different this time because you've got so many pace bowlers out there. Maybe it's, you know, four getting 15 wickets.
The Australian chapter of your book, I mean, your book is not a complete, it's not a cricket book, is it? I mean, there's a lot of cricket in there.
Travel book.
Yeah, exactly. It's a combination of travel writing, cricket writing, and a bit of memoir in there, isn't there? And there's a couple of stories you tell in the Aussie chapter. I really enjoyed the one about Rodney Hogg bursting onto the scene and absolutely scuppering your plans for the Sunday feature.
Yes, I enjoyed that. And he ended up with, 40-odd wickets at 12. I had to downplay him for reasons I tried to explain in the book because of a feature I'd written early in the week. And I didn't realise at the time that was the first series in Australia where the Kookaburra ball was machine-stitched or hand-stitched. And so I was even prouder than normal. And Hoggy was jagging it back big time to have Boyk Selby W. And, he had the most tremendous series. I mean, even better than Mitchell Johnson, wasn't it, statistically, or something like that. And, that made my working life a bit more difficult.
Another story I liked in the book. I mean, one of the things I've always tried to do when I've gone away abroad to cover cricket is use the days off to actually explore a little bit. Because I think there's too many people go on tours, they get out of bed, they go to the cricket ground. On a day off, they might go to the golf course or sit around the pool, and they never actually really see the country. I like to explore and discover a few things, and you seem to be of the same ilk there.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was for the first, I don't know, 30 odd years of my career, I was a Sunday newspaper journalist, and that offers the opportunity to get away in the first part of the week, to go up country or disappear into the bush or whatever, and hopefully find, you know, a cricketer who's come from up country or from the bush to make the expedition worthwhile. But now, I mean, particularly nowadays, There basically really isn't a day off. It's sort of far more of a business trip. And so, you know, the daily journalist cannot get away because there's always going to be a press conference and you have to be, you know, around the team hotel in case something happens. So it's very difficult to go off piste.
I'm always reluctant to ask somebody that's written a book to tell me all of the stories in the book, because that's what the viewers and listeners want to be buying the book to find out. But there is a particular one where you head off on a bike in Australia, and then you feel a bit of pain on top of your head. Would you like to retell that for me?
Well, yeah, it's Australia is man and nature in Australia are less kind than they are, normally are in Britain. It's a wilder, more physical environment. So yeah, I was biking along somewhere near Bunbury in Western Australia on the coast south of Perth, and I felt always, because it's Australia, health and safety, you have to wear a helmet, you know, fair enough. And I felt this bang on the back of my head, and then, you know, not quite fell off, but kept biking. And then about 20 seconds later, another bang on the back of my head, you know, a real thump. And I was, what on earth's going on? And apparently it was a magpie that likes to take tufts of hair from passing cyclists for its nest. I mean, you'd never get a British magpie doing something as impolite as that, would you? You just equate it with sort of club cricket in Australia, you know, when the sledging would be comparable to that magpie assaulting you. And you either live with it or get out of the kitchen.
And your friend over there told you that the kind of the gleam of your cycling helmet, the magpie recognised there's hair underneath that, and it might be good for his nest and basically to take it away. So not ideal, that, is it, as he's cycling along, to have a magpie attacking you, a bionic magpie by the sounds of it. If I could get you to basically go back at any stage over the last four decades and you could relive any one day in the press box and have that experience again, where would you take me?
The most dramatic test match I've seen was Kingston 1986, when Malcolm Marshall and Patrick Patterson on his debut bowled most frighteningly quick and dangerous bowling I've ever seen. And I think that any of those England batsmen had ever seen. Graham Gooch said it was the only time in his life he'd been afraid on a cricket field. Yeah. And I think it's probably about day three. England went in for their second innings and the pitch was beginning to crack, which is bad enough facing anybody. But Patrick Patterson making his debut hometown, a Jamaica lad who was trying to make a living out of cricket. Marshall at the other end didn't want to see anybody else bowling remotely as fast as he did. So he was trying to match Patterson in speed. And the speed of the action, I can't prove this because it was the last England test match of which there is no camera footage, no video footage, no live footage at all. And the only way I can convey the speed of the action is by what the ball was doing out there. One ball went over the batsman's head, Geoffrey Dujon's head, and pitched once before going over the boundary. And I remember in both of them, he took on Malcolm Marshall, bowling round the wicket. And the substitute, it was Jimmy Adams. He was only about 17, you know, probably still at school, but he was the West Indies substitute, and he was three quarters of the way back, i.e. halfway between the square leg umpire and the boundary. And Beefy hooked him, and it went out to Adams, who, being a brilliant fielder even then, fired it back into the keeper. And there was no time to take a run. I mean, you could accuse Both of not trying for the single. Such was the speed of the action. So quick was the bowling. So quick was the shot. And so quick was the return. Even though it went to deepish square leg. No time for a single. That was the speed of the action.
I had a comment in here from Hattie who says, so good to be part of this. Shield, one of my journalistic people I truly look up to, she says, inspired her greatly. So you've got some fans out there, Shield, who read your stuff and appreciate it.
Well, bless you, Hattie. Yeah, well, all I can do is try and convey the enjoyment and excitement I've been able to experience these last 40 years. You know, try and get it down on paper in the newspaper and in books so that others can enjoy, you know, vicariously what I've been privileged to do.
My name is Jacob and I sent the Badger a message and now I'm on the podcast with this jingle. If you would like to get in touch with the Cricket Badger podcast, then tweet @cricket_badger.
When I've been abroad, as I say, I've not been anywhere near as extensive as you, but you tend to find, I mean, going to Barbados, the roundabouts are named after players, and you can feel cricket coming out of the pores of the country almost. Going to the UAE, which is obviously a man-made, fairly new venture, getting into a taxi there, asking the taxi driver to take me to the Zayed Stadium on the periphery of Abu Dhabi, and the taxi driver just looks blank, and there's a $35 million stadium there, and he has no idea what it's been used for, despite the fact he drives past it every day, because cricket isn't quite in the psyche in the UAE as it is in Barbados. You must have found that to varying degrees, that some countries just live and breathe cricket, and some countries are a little more maybe apathetic towards it.
Yeah, which is fair enough. Not everybody has to be obsessed. But I mean, they should be.
In a perfect world, they should be.
Yeah, it would be nearer to perfect world if everybody played cricket and watched the game. I suppose it would be a better place. But I think you're right, Barbados would be the place on Earth now. And maybe, you know, for the last 100 years, where a higher proportion of the population knows about cricket than anywhere else.
I was trying to find a quiet corner, a ground in Barbados, only a small pre-season friendly between two counties. And I wanted to take my laptop somewhere quiet so I could just work on something. And they said, oh, there's a room upstairs. I've never been anywhere more noisy. There were three gentlemen in this room and they were having a conversation, and it is the most animated, noisy conversation, I think, because they are so passionate about the sport, aren't they? You get into a conversation with a Bayesian, and they are passionate.
Yeah, I tried to convey that. Well, you know what it's like to be in the press box in the West Indies. And, yes, the conversation that's going on, occasionally with a preference being expressed by some of the journalists for the cricketers from their island, but... Yeah, I mean, the press box is part of the main stand to all intents and purposes in the West Indies. Such is the animation and enthusiasm.
I asked you before we came, we pressed record, if I could tempt you to read a passage from your book, Beyond the Boundaries, maybe a favourite passage or a passage you know well, so the listeners and viewers can listen to you telling it. Would you like to find a page and maybe read a little bit to us?
Just a page, or
you go for it. Whatever you think is the right duration. It's your podcast.
Well, it's a page and a half.
Okay.
This is the start of the chapter about Pakistan. Are we sitting comfortably?
I certainly am.
Then I'll begin. It is said that we retain a soft spot for our first beloved. I retain one for the country I first toured, Pakistan. A dark-bearded 23-year-old Englishman came to Karachi in 1844 and was soon hailed as the finest mind of his generation. Richard Burton arrived as a surveyor in what is now Pakistan, avid for adventure. I was 23 when I arrived there on my first England tour in 1977. Burton took a boat up the River Indus through Sind, S-C-I-N-D-E. As he spelt it when he published the first account in English of this region. Another difference is that Burton was able to do enough local research to form the practical basis of his infamous translation of the Kama Sutra. Karachi was more than 150 years old when Burton first saw it, and after the oysters that produced pearls had been exhausted, had become a fishing village of baked mud. The population of 2,000 was a mixture of Hindus, Muslims, and African slaves, and as a whole, manly and well-developed. While the women seldom wear veils in the streets, such was the potential of Karachi, that Burton thought it was the young Alexandria of our young Egypt. In other words, a very promising port in the making. Beyond the settlement, however, the plain around us is nothing but an expanse of sand, broken into rises and falls by the furious winds, and scarcely affording thorns and fire plants sufficient to feed a dozen ghosts and camels. In order to travel around Pakistan, I arrived a fortnight before the start of England's tour in 1977, and before the snows cut off the mountain passes. Burton, multilingual, was making his survey of Sindh as the only army officer who could speak Sindhi. And he was smitten when he beheld, in Larkana, a Nautch, or dancing girl. He called her the Donna of Larkana, clad as she was in gold, jewellery, brocade, and satin. Your eyes, weary with the beauties of her face, shift to her figure, where, if perfection ever was, there you discover it. She floats forward so softly that trace of exertion is imperceptible. Slowly waving her white arms, she unexpectedly stands close to you, then turning with a pirouette. Reliable rumour has it that a Pakistan batsman, who had better not be named, and who was visiting a Nautch girl of similar charms in Lahore, had to make a sudden escape and fell off a roof, thus ending his cricket career. The Donna of Larkana was off limits. Her younger sister, however, might not have been. After Burton's death, his wife unearthed a notebook of his unpublished poems, including one entitled Past Loves. Burton, in his youth, had got around, she discovered, as much as his later Welsh namesake. So this is one verse he wrote. The Nubians and the Abyssinians sent me at least a score of minions. And you remember Burton went in search of the Nile in those parts. So a score, Burton's total has already risen to 20. Yet his all-time favourite, so it would seem from this poem, was Nur Jahan, the Donna's younger sister. But of them all, the fair Nur Jahan, the Venus of Baluchistan, was most to my mind. So, yeah, that's when I arrived in Pakistan. I didn't quite follow in Burton's footsteps, but it was a, I've got a soft spot for Pakistan, having been my first tour.
It was looking like cricket was returning to Pakistan properly, wasn't it, until recently? But it'd be lovely to get it back there, wouldn't it?
Yes, I mean, what a disastrous bit of decision-making that was. I mean, two T20 games in Pakistan. He wouldn't have to have been, you know, the absolute top first 11 to go there and not to carry that out. I mean, well, heads have rolled, haven't they, at the ECB, or at least one head since. Just disastrous decision-making.
I said at the time I've been on longer stag do's than that tour was going to be.
I'm sure you have, James.
Yeah, I'm not going to put that in a book. I'm going to show you a picture now. Of a very, there's the man in action.
And where's the leading arm? Why haven't I got my leading arm up? I've been playing for 80 years and I haven't got my leading arm up high enough. Anyway, that's what I'm working on in pre-season training.
You're saying here, because you look like you got black socks on, but the caption corrects that by the fact that you've got shin guards on, haven't you?
Yes. Have you ever had it drilled back straight at your ankles?
I've managed to escape that so far, but that's basically, it says in the caption that, you know, I guess advancing years means you can't get down as quickly.
No. And you don't want to, you can't afford another boundary. So I stick my foot out and try and stop it that way.
But you've taken quite a few wickets. I can't find the little, the blurb here, but you record wicket taker for your club or something?
One of my teammates has digitized all the scorecards since he started playing about 20 odd years ago. So obviously, the scorecards before that have not been digitized. And simply on the basis of the digitized one of the last 22 years or something, have taken most wickets. So they're lies, they're damn lies, they're statistics. And then most deceptive of all, there are records based on the scorecards which have been digitized.
Yeah, I suppose you'd phrase that as the leading wicket taker of the modern era, wouldn't you?
Oh, I wouldn't qualify it like that. I'd just say leading recorded wicket taker. Recorded, that's the thing. Yeah, so I mean, plenty of old-timers took 100 wickets in a season, you know, 50 years ago. But I'll take it, as they say.
Going back through your time in the game and going abroad, obviously, because this book is about your travels abroad, if I was to give you sufficient money to buy a nice first-class airfare to go to any of these countries, which one would you pick as a holiday destination?
For a holiday?
Yeah.
How long's a holiday?
2 weeks, and we'll give you 2 weeks.
Okay, I think I'm going to, and it's not economy, is it?
Oh, no, you can stretch.
Right. In that case, I think I'd make it New Zealand, and specifically on the North Island, on the West Coast, there's a smallish town called Raglan, and I love boogie boarding, bodyboarding, you know, lying on a board and being borne ashore by the waves. And Raglan is, I think, along with Crane Beach in Barbados, those are the two favourite boogie boarding venues. I was thinking of calling the book Boogie Boarding with Blowers, but I've never been boogie boarding with Henry Blofeld, and I think you'd have rung up and said, my dear old thing, I love you dearly, but my lawyers are going to sue you for suggesting that I've been boogie boarding with you.
When I went to Barbados once, Shields, I hired a car. I did a circuit of the island, because it's not a big island, in a day. I ended up sitting on Crane Beach for an hour, just on my own, had it all to myself.
Oh, it is fantastic for boogie boarding. Just one proviso, that the Sargasso Sea hasn't brought in a lot of seaweed. But even then, you know, the temperature's just perfect. The waves are perfect. So, yeah, many a happy hour spent there.
Yeah. I've never done boogie boarding. I certainly didn't do that day anyway. The my period in press boxes, a lot of the days that you have in press boxes are made by your companions in those press boxes, the chat, the helping each other out, and the camaraderie that often extends into the evening as well. I guess you've got exactly the same kind of slant on that yourself.
I have to say that when I joined the press box, I must have been a pretty insufferable 22, 23-year-old. Everybody's sort of twice my age on the international, the England international circuit. So, everybody wore a jacket and blue trousers and wore a tie, but I didn't. Now is so much more individuality allowed. Yeah, some fascinating differences. In those days, you got the alcohol flowing before the lunch interval. And I can remember seeing John Arlott for the first time in the Trembridge press box in 1973. I thought, he's getting something out of his basket. You know, it's a bottle. What is it? You know, is it some 1927 vintage from France? And it was from a supermarket called Nicholas. And, you know, it was the most straight plonk. But I suppose that was just the first bottle of maybe one or two. So, yeah, in those days, everybody drank and just had a sort of sandwich at lunchtime. Whereas a couple of years later, Cornhill became the insurance, and they offered food and wine for lunch. But nowadays, it's just food. So that's one big difference. The members of the press corps are younger, and often, you know, some of them go for 10-mile runs before breakfast. And nobody in my day when I started did anything like that. Golf on a rest day was the activity of choice. So, yeah, huge differences in lifestyle.
I can remember being a spectator at a Benson Hedges Cup game, walking around the back of the stands, and they were doling out boxes of cigarettes. And the sponsors, you know, times change quite rapidly, don't they, in terms of things like that. The relationship between press and players has changed down the years as well, hasn't it? I mean, I've seen the pictures in your book, and I know you mentioned it in your book about being on tour and, you know, having drinks at night with the players and what have you, whereas there is a little bit more of a separation between the press and the players these days.
Yeah, far more so. I mean, the younger members of the press corps are closer to the players, I would say, in general, than the older ones. But it's still nothing like what it used to be. You know, when I started, all the press and all the players met in the bar every evening, and everything, you know, what happened out there, we got to know. And it was all in confidence. Nowadays, I don't know, the last 20 years has been sort of at least one press conference every day, it seems, you know, officially orchestrated. So we have a limited insight into what each player who's put up for that daily press conference is thinking and doing, but it's not like the sort of complete entrust confidence that you could do. But writing up the quotes is, you know, what we're fed on a daily basis, whether it's the best thing for the reader. I don't know, it's for readers to judge.
Can you see a time where there won't be press boxes and people will just cover cricket from home effectively? I mean, people have been doing that in COVID, and I think there's a lot of good that's come out of COVID in terms of working practices. But one of the dangers as far as journalism is concerned, that newspapers, etc., think, oh, why should I send that fella to Australia when he can watch it overnight at home and write it up from home?
Mm. It seemed to be that some newspapers are thinking exactly that. I think certain newspapers will always want to have somebody there because why? Because I think if you're in the crowd, preferably behind the arm, you have a better feel than anybody else for which way a match is going. Mm. This may apply to white ball. I wouldn't have seen enough T20 internationals to be able to say that for sure. But the one thing, obviously, if you're out there playing, you get details which the people on the outside of the boundary don't have access to. But just to be able to stand back and see how the game is going, I think you get a surer feel for that from that perspective than any other. So watching on telly doesn't give you that feel of which way the game is going, because you just sort of see the way that the body language of the players, you know, are they getting, you know, a bit downhearted? Are they really sensing that they're in? So there is a uniquely informed, in that sense, perspective to be had by being at the ground, preferably behind the arm.
I think as well, Shield, if you're watching it off the TV, commentary teams are really good, but you are influenced by their opinion rather than actually formulating your own, aren't you, as well?
And you're subject to what the editor, the pictures that he wants to show you.
Just got a couple more questions for you before I let you go and enjoy the rest of your day. If I was to give you a choice of going to any ground in the world, I know when I went to Cape Town, I already knew Table Mountain was up there and the ground was going to be good because I'd seen it on the television. But that was one of the few places I've actually walked into the edge of the outfield and the ground's opened up in front of me and I've actually just gone, wow, this is incredible. I guess there's a few on your list like that, aren't there?
Oh, favourites, yeah. I got fond memories of playing in a media match in Cape Town a couple of years ago, and how easy it was to see the ball, the light in Cape Town, the clarity of it. Just to see the ball coming at you, it's nice to hang on. I'd have several, top half dozen test venues around the world. It depends which bit you're looking at. Is it the ground or the backdrop? but whatever the combination, Sabina Park's fantastic because you can see the Blue Mountains beyond. If you're at the George Headley stand end, Port of Spain, the mountains behind at one end. If you're watching from the Tregarity Road, the main pavilion end, and see the hills beyond that. Just magnificent sights. St. Vincent, England played a one-day international there, and you can see across the channel from St. Vincent to Bequay and the odd ship going past, you know, the waters sort of glistening. That's a one-day international, not a test ground. Adelaide Oval's obviously a wonderful sight from the city end and, you know, the old scoreboard and St. Peter's Cathedral behind. But some of the boutique grounds in New Zealand are as beautiful as any. Mount Maunganui, you get the shot of the mount. But the ground as a whole, you know, it's behind a timber yard. And it's not quite as attractive as it sounds. Hagley Oval, Christchurch, is right up there. It's just a couple of temporary stands put up, but it's in the middle of this oval and the trees there. And Trala Trala, the River Avon, and, you know, boating on there. And it's as beautiful as anywhere.
It's said that you nearly made 500 test matches. Do you know what the exact number is?
No, I haven't counted up. With New Zealand cricket, Kane Williamson on their behalf kindly gave me a pendant for marking 450 at Wellington a couple of years ago. No, Christchurch, a couple of years ago. Some more since then, but not all because of COVID.
You weren't tempted just to stay on another 18 months or whatever it would have taken to get to 500?
Richie Benno saw 500. And I think he should hold the world record permanently.
it's not a bad thing to have the silver medal behind Richie Benno, is it? He was all right.
Yeah, and he played in 60s, 70s, didn't he? That's not fair.
The final question, Shield, came from Andrew on Twitter, who said he's looking forward to your book. Is it going to be available on audiobook as well, or is it just going to be on in hard copy?
I don't know. I hadn't heard or thought of an audio version, but hopefully that page or so will be going on. But thank you for the suggestion. I shall ask the publishers.
They can cut out your page and a half from this. That gives them a head start, doesn't it, when you've read that out anyway. Shield Berry, it's been an absolute pleasure. Beyond the Boundaries, Travels on England Cricket Tours, and available in all good and bad bookshops, I guess, and available online now in time for Christmas for loved ones that like cricket. And if you like cricket yourself, it's a very good read. As I say, I've read the first couple of chapters. I intend to devour the rest of it over the forthcoming week. Shield, it's been a pleasure to catch up with you, and have a very Merry Christmas. Enjoy the Ashes.
Thank you very much, James, and listeners.
And thanks, everybody out there, for watching / listening. Coming up towards 500. Got, hopefully, Shield's a very special guest, but a very special guest coming up for number 500. And hopefully I'll be able to tell you a little bit more about that very soon indeed. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks again to Shield. And I'll see you all again very soon indeed.
Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.